We are in chapter 20 of 1 Samuel. We're ready to continue tonight in verse 32, so that you'll realize where we ended the last time. David was not present for the feast of New Moon that was being celebrated by Saul and his household. And Saul assumed that perhaps there was a valid reason for him not being present the first day. Maybe he had not completed his purification rites. Maybe he'd come in contact with a dead body or something. So didn't really think much about it until the second day. By that time, he was concerned. And prior to this, David and Jonathan had met together. And David has been telling Jonathan all the way along that his father is really making life miserable for him. And David is concerned about the threats against his life. Jonathan is not quite persuaded as yet, but he's about to be thoroughly persuaded. But he makes a covenant relationship with David. And he indicates that they will meet again. They'll meet out in the field. And there's a stone out there called Ezel, E-Z-E-L. And he urges David to be by that stone. That way, when Jonathan returns to the field, he can give David a warning without anybody knowing that that's what he's doing. He will bring his fellow out that helps him in his archery practice. And he will fire some, or shoot some arrows into the sky. And he will call out to the young man that goes after the arrows. And the words that he uses in speaking to the young lad at that time will end up being a code language in which Jonathan is able to communicate with David if perchance they don't even see each other or get close enough to carry on a conversation. As it turns out, they will get close enough. They will have a conversation. And David will recognize, as he already is persuaded, but Jonathan will be persuaded too, that his life is at risk. And he's going to now be spending the rest of his life, at least as long as Saul is alive and is occupying the throne, he'll spend his life as a fugitive. So that's where we are in our study. And in verses 32 and 33, Jonathan answered Saul, his father, and said to him, "Why should he be put to death? What has he done?" Then Saul hurled his spear at him to strike him down. So Jonathan knew that his father had decided to put David to death. So the anger that Saul has been venting against David is now being vented against his own son. Now, did Jonathan ignore his father's personal attack? What are your answers?
Well, I said, yeah. Well, in that he didn't look at him as his father was really attacking him. He was just mad about David.
Yes, I think you're exactly right. I just didn't hear you, and I wanted to make sure I didn't misunderstand you. How did Jonathan stand up for David? Yeah, and he's saying, what have you got against him? Why do you feel this way about him? What has he done that actually deserves the death? You know, he's fought your battles for you. He's really done some amazing things. He's proved to be very loyal, very effective as a warrior. Now, how did Saul answer Jonathan's questions? With action, didn't he?
Pointedly.
Very pointedly, all right. I like that. With a spear and threatened to kill his own son, which is showing the extent of his anger. Was Jonathan now convinced of his father's anger against David and of David's danger?
Yes,
he was. All right, verse 34, please.
Then Jonathan arose from the table in fierce anger and did not eat food on the second day of the new moon, for he was grieved over David because his father had dishonored him.
All right, what was Jonathan's reaction to his father's decision to kill David? All right, we have kind of a two words that are used to describe this, aren't they? What's the first word?
Anger.
Anger, and the second word is?
Grief.
And, the two kind of mix together here. He was grieved for David. He loved David. He knew that his father was not being fair and really bothered him. Is it ever all right for us to get angry?
Yes,
but what does the Bible say about our anger?
Be angry and sin not.
All right, sin not. Let not the sun go down upon your wrath. All right. Did Jonathan eat because it was a feast of joy?
No.
No, his grief has robbed him of his appetite. Does that sound strange to you?
No.
Not at all. Is Jonathan learning more about his father than he had not known before?
Yes.
Believe that he is. How does this verse speak to the character of Jonathan?
He's loyal friend.
He certainly is loyal to his friend. And he really has a proper sense of values. And his emotional makeup is right on target. And he realizes that he now is in a key position to offer David some help, but it's the kind of help he hoped that he wouldn't have to give to him.
Another thing, too, by Jonathan asking questions of his father, the king, he's not telling the king. He's giving the king an opportunity to give an explanation.
Yeah.
It might be different if he said, "Dad, you are wrong. Dad, you shouldn't do that." He didn't do that at all. He asked questions.
Yes. That's well said. Sometimes in asking questions, we make a statement by the question we ask, don't we? All right, very good. Verses 35 through 37, please.
Now it came about in the morning that Jonathan went out to the field for the appointment with David, and a little lad was with him. He said to his lad, "Right now, I'm about to shoot." As the lad was running, he shot an arrow past him. When the lad reached the place of the arrow which Jonathan had shot, Jonathan called after the lad and said, "Is not the arrow beyond you?"
Okay, so what does "in the morning" tell us with regard to the time? All right, this is the third day now. So this is the time that the festival is now over and people get back into the normal routine. So is Jonathan. Now, what would keep anyone from being suspicious about Jonathan going out into the field?
Normal action.
Yes, it was. Going out for archery practice, probably with this lad with him. Is Jonathan hopeful that David is still in hiding?
Yes,
he is. What is significant about the words of Jonathan to the lad who ran after the arrows?
It was the sign for David that he's in trouble.
That's right. In other words, it gives the appearance to anybody that doesn't know what's going on that he's talking to the lad. In reality, though he is, he's really talking more to his friend David and giving David an important signal. Verse 38, please.
Jonathan cried after the lad, "Make speed, haste, stay not." And Jonathan lads gathered up the arrows and came to his master.
Okay, so who was Jonathan speaking to?
David,
right. Even though it gives the appearance that he's speaking to the lad. Why did Jonathan want the lad to be quick?
Because danger is ahead.
All right, he's telling David that time is very important. He's also wanting the lad to get out of the way because he's hoping to have a private moment alone with David and to make sure that David really has heard him and he'll realize how important time is in his making an escape for his life. But the lad was not aware of anything. Only Jonathan and David knew about the matter. Then Jonathan gave his weapons to the lad and said to him, "Go bring them to the city." Now, why did Jonathan tell the lad to take his weapons back to the city? That's right. And this will open up the door where Jonathan can have this one final visit with David. Verse 41, please.
When the lad was gone, David rose from the south side and fell on his face to the ground. And bowed three times, and they kissed each other and wept together. But David wept the more.
How did David realize that Jonathan wanted to talk to him before they parted? Yeah, that makes it very clear. Why did David weep more than Jonathan? Yes, but wouldn't Jonathan have that same reason for weeping? Oh, yeah. David has a lot more to fear, doesn't he? A lot more to be concerned about than Jonathan does. And his future is so uncertain. You know, he's a young fellow. He's probably in his 20s at this time. And you have to really feel for a fellow like this when you know that 24 hours, day and night, he is running for his life. Where will he get the food? Will anybody really help him? What does the future hold for him? And why should this happen to him? Obviously, he's learning from his own experience that good things can happen. I mean, the bad things can happen to good people, because they certainly are to David. And what is he going to do? Well, he's going to miss being with his friend, obviously. How does David express thanks and show respect for Jonathan for saving his life? Yeah. The posture, his action, his words, the tears. And by the way, do tears really speak volumes? Yes, they do. Sometimes tears say something that words just cannot express adequately. And so a genuine emotion is showing here in David, and the affection that they have for each other is also being expressed. Jonathan said to David, "Go in safety, inasmuch as we have sworn to each other in the name of the Lord, saying, the Lord will be between me and you, and between my descendants and your descendants forever." Then he rose and departed while Jonathan went into the city. Did Jonathan send David away in peace? Yes, as we learned way back in verse 13, that he promised that he would do. So what we're going to find in the rest of 1 Samuel is what it's like to be an outlaw. What it's like to be a fugitive. What it's like to live from day to day, knowing that your life is in danger and you're running for your life. David now recognizes that he has no option. He had to get away as far as he could from Saul, or else he might be killed. Those who write on the 1 Samuel and have made a careful study of this believe that he was probably about 24 years of age at this time. All right, interesting start of his escape is being described in this 21st chapter. Would you read verse 1, please?
And David came to Nob to Abimelech, the priest. And Abimelech came trembling to meet David and said to him, "Why are you alone and no one is with you?"
All right, what has David done and is now doing to stay alive? All right, first of all, he had gone to Samuel, then to Jonathan, and neither one of them was able to provide any safety for him. And so now he is going to the priest at the tabernacle, and this is located in Nob. Nob was a place that was a few miles northeast of Jerusalem, not too far away from Jerusalem. I observe in my study that people are not exactly sure the exact mileage, but obviously more than 2 or 3 miles, and perhaps as much as 10 or 11 miles. Well, who was Ahimelech?
Priest.
All right, he's one of 85 priests who lived in this general area of Nob, where at this time the ark is located, the tabernacle is located. He was a great-grandson of Eli. Now, what do we know is going to happen ultimately to all the offspring of Eli as far as the priesthood is concerned? It's going to come to an end. It's exactly right. Hasn't completely come to an end yet, but it certainly will be. And Ahimelech is serving at this time. Now, why did Ahimelech tremble when David arrived?
Probably been spread around, but
he's heard through the grapevine.
I'm sorry?
He
He's heard it through the grapevine.
Yeah, that's possible. It's also possible that he thinks, David, why are you alone? And then, of course, in a moment, he's going to say, no, he's not really alone. There are others with him. What are you doing here? Would David's reputation have been pretty well known throughout the countryside? Oh, absolutely. And he had been highly praised and very successful in his military activities. And the very fact that he comes unarmed and doesn't seem to be in battle array at this time, he has some question marks. What are you doing here? Is this a secret mission? Are you here because the king has sent you? And if he has, why is he sending you? And if not, why are you here?
Am I in trouble?
Yeah. I think that he's being very cautious. I think that he doesn't want to get into trouble. I think that he probably is very much aware of the discord that prevails between Saul and David. But he may not have known how serious it was when even Saul's own son had not realized till very recently just how serious it was. Verse 2, please.
David said to Ahimelech the priest, "The king has commissioned me with a matter and has said to me, 'Let no one know anything about the matter on which I am sending you and with which I have commissioned you, and I have directed the young men to a certain place.'"
All right, did David admit to the priest that he was fleeing from David?
From Saul?
No, he didn't. Do you think there's a reason why? Yes, if Ahimelech realized that David was running away from Saul, would that possibly influence Ahimelech in a negative way as far as David's need at this particular point?
Yes.
Well, I think very definitely.
Because he would have had to upheld the law and the law that he would have heard.
Yeah. Did David tell a lie on this occasion? It's interesting to read what different people who write on this subject have to say. Some people think that he did, and some people think that he didn't. Does he identify Saul by name?
No.
Could he have referred to anybody else with the word king?
Sure, it's a general.
Could have referred to God, could he not?
If he talked with a capital K or a small K.
Yeah.
Right.
And it's this reason why people are differing in their opinions. The Bible does not make it entirely clear. Is it possible that David realizes that where he is now is where God wants him to be? Is that a possibility? Is it significant that he should go to where the Ark of the Covenant is, where the tabernacle is, where the priests are? I mean, where else is he going to go? Is David a man of God?
Yes,
he is. And he certainly wants a counsel of God. And he's not been able to get the help that he feels like he really needs. But at this point, he's got some real pressing needs. And so he comes to the priest, where he hopes to be able to have some kind of help given to him. Now, these people that are with David are not identified as such. They probably are some of his very close friends or servants that have been with him over a period of time, and their loyalty to him has remained, even though they recognize that David and Saul are not in good relationships at this time. By the way, our Lord makes reference to this event. In Mark chapter 2 and verse 26, Jesus identifies these men that were with David on this occasion as his servants, and that he does not speak disparagingly of David for his request for something to eat and the fact that the request was granted. That is significant. Now, does what the New Testament reports from the Old Testament ever give us added insight that we didn't gain from the Old Testament itself?
Yes,
it does. And I think this probably enters into the thinking of some people who wonder about David's language and what he is saying, and and the fact that he is very careful not to use the name of Saul and uses the word king, when in reality he may have a different king in mind than Saul himself, referring to God, of course. Would you read verse 3, please?
Now therefore, what do you have on hand? Give me 5 loaves of bread or whatever can be found.
All right, were David and his men in need of help at this time?
Yes,
obviously they needed something to eat. Verse 4, please.
The priest answered David and said, there is no ordinary bread on hand, but there is consecrated bread. If only the young men have kept themselves from women.
All right, what is ordinary bread? When I was a little kid, our church building had a basement. And when the communion service was over, the people who had served the communion took the trays down to the basement and put them in the kitchen. When I learned that as a little kid, just as soon as the service was over, I went down. Guess what I did? I had an early dinner. I drank the grape juice that had not been consumed, and I ate the unleavened bread that had not been eaten. When my parents found out about that, they were not very happy. And so that came quickly to an end. So when we're talking here about the ordinary bread, what is ordinary bread?
Bread that has leaven in it. Raisin or what?
Something to raise the bread. Because the other bread would be unleavened bread.
It's common bread. It's for everybody to use.
I'm sorry?
It would be common bread meant for everybody to have.
Yeah, I don't think the presence or absence of yeast has anything to do with it. I just think that it is making a distinction between the 12 loaves that were placed upon the table of showbread every Sabbath day that replaced the 12 loaves that had been on there for a week. And these loaves were consecrated as a part of the religious service that took place in the tabernacle. And consequently, God intended that these loaves should only be eaten by the priests. Other bread could be eaten by anybody. But I think he's making a distinction between bread that has some kind of religious attachment to it as opposed to bread that does not.
Excuse me, Professor Warren, is there a bread that they have, unleavened bread and leavened bread, that they use?
In the tabernacle?
I'm not sure I know what you're asking. Did they have both kinds of bread, with yeast and without it?
Yes.
Oh, I'm sure they did. Yeah.
Well, for Passover, they have to eat
unleavened bread.
Yes,
was
the unleavened was had the religious significance. But
that's what I am saying.
But people could eat bread whether it was unleavened or had yeast in it, either way. But the bread in the tabernacle had to be unleavened bread. Which raises an interesting question in our day. Do we use unleavened bread in our observance of the Lord's Supper?
No.
We don't?
Yes.
That's not bread. When I make it, we do. That's not bread. That's just a little thing that's
crackers.
Easy. I'm sorry.
I think I hit a tender spot. I better change my thought.
Yeah, Professor Born in Seattle, the church there, they eventually, one lady took it over to where she just provided it, made sure we had it. But the ladies there actually did go and make unleavened bread.
Yeah, so have I. Lots of times. So,
but that's all Crown Hill ever used.
People complain about it. So.
Well, I like it a lot better than what we use over Restoration with the matzah. Thanks.
Yeah, actually, it's
tasty. I don't want to puncture your balloon. But in the New Testament, the word that is translated bread, that refers to the Lord's Supper, is not necessarily unleavened bread. It's a generic term for bread. Now, there's a reason why we choose to use unleavened bread. Because when was the Lord's Supper instituted?
Jesus.
resurrection.
That's right. And they only had unleavened bread at the Passover feast. So that would have been the kind of bread that was used then. I was in a church one time where when they observed the Lord's Supper, they had a loaf of bread on the table. And one of the men went up there and just simply broke that loaf in two. And then they passed one loaf around on one side and the other on the other side. It was not unleavened bread at all. So this is why we have discussions. When you realize that the word that is used for whatever reason is a generic term for bread and does not specify unleavened bread, and yet you know that it was unleavened to begin with, how far do you press details like that?
Well, like grape juice and wine. I mean, it was, you know, the wine doesn't necessarily have to mean it's alcoholic. It's too fermented. It just means it's, they couldn't drink the water because the water was good, not good, so they drank juice. It doesn't mean it had to be fermented juice.
Interestingly enough, however, every time that the Lord's Supper is being spoken of, it never uses the term wine. Not once. It always uses the term fruit of the vine.
Okay.
So we can be, I think, reasonably sure in that area, because I don't see a crack in the door. In fact, I would suggest that it's probably appropriate that we use the language of scriptures at the Lord's table with regard to the fruit of the vine, because there are those who do use intoxicated wine in the observance of the Lord's Supper, which is a departure, I believe, from what the scriptures are actually saying.
That's what you get in Haiti, but that's better than what it would be because they don't have refrigeration. So it's always kind of a surprise. It's horrible stuff.
Yeah.
You wouldn't, as a child, have gone down and finished it off.
Thank you for having a high opinion of me. Why was it important that those receiving this bread must not have slept with women on the previous night?
It was consecrated.
That's right, and it was a matter of the law. And this is in Leviticus chapter 15 and verse 18. And the same rule applied to warriors who were involved in a holy war. They were bound by this same rule. David and his men were engaged in a holy mission, and the priests would share the holy bread with them. So there's a real concern here about making sure we understand what this is for and who can possibly avail themselves of the use of it now, meeting a real need. Did this bread, since this bread was for the priests, does it appear that Ahimelech bent the rules to make some available to David and his men?
Yes,
I think so. Do we ever bend rules and not feel too guilty about doing so?
It's a matter of here.
Just talk about it.
And here too, what day was it? When was that bread getting ready to be replaced?
Okay.
Was it just put there or had it been there a week?
Okay.
Christ, and it says about them boys sleeping with women. Wasn't them boys supposed to be married back in them days too before they slept with a woman? Or?
Yes.
Oh, absolutely. That's been true from the beginning of time.
Yeah.
Still today.
But I mean, a bunch of them young were running around, and they wasn't, don't sound like they was married if they was on the run. I mean,
Well, we better be careful not to read something in there that the Bible doesn't say.
Just wondering. If it talks about in the mother ward where they did their spoils.
I feel very confident myself that because of the wording of verse 4, that these men were married men. Otherwise, there had been no reason for the priest to add this particular comment with regard to whether they were really fit to receive the bread that he had to offer them. All right, verse 5, please.
David answered the priest and said to him, "Surely women have been kept from us as previously when I set out, and the vessels of the young men were holy. Though it was an ordinary journey, how much more then today will their vessels be holy?"
So what two alternatives did David, two affirmations rather, did David make? Well, first of all, he said the men had not been with their wives since yesterday and the day before. And secondly, when David set out with the men, their clothes, whatever they brought with them, were holy. In other words, as far as the Levitical law was concerned, they would have been considered clean. That's what he's saying here. Now, the meaning of the last part of this verse is the thought that the mission of these men to the tabernacle was sanctified because David, God's chosen instrument, had come with a very real and pressing need. And so he felt that this is where God wanted him to be, and what he had to ask for was what God would approve of on this occasion. Would you read verse 6, please?
So the priest gave him consecrated bread, for there was no bread there, but the bread of the presence, which was removed from before the Lord, in order to put hot bread in its place when it was taken away.
Okay, how could Ahimelech give David bread, which was only to be eaten by the priest? How's that?
It's good while they were taking it off to replace it.
Yeah.
Shelf life.
I'm sorry?
Shelf life.
Okay. Okay.
This said it was removed from before the Lord in order to put hot bread in its place.
Yeah. To me, the bottom line is, when Jesus made reference to this, he had no criticism of what was being done here. So the precise moment that this happened is not really the idea that's being expressed so much as the fact that they did not make a mistake in doing this, that circumstances determined that this was the appropriate thing to do on this particular occasion. Let me make sure that I didn't leave something hanging that I might be misunderstood. The Bible says, forsake not the assembling of yourselves together. That is a clear law of God. However, I don't think that the Lord intends for us, when we have a contagious disease and it could be easily infecting other people, the Lord intends us to be in the assembly on that day. So it's a case of where the law is suspended, but the love for the Lord is not suspended. In other words, you're using good common sense that the Lord gave to you.
The spirit of the law versus legalistic.
Yeah, you're exactly right.
Too much into anything.
Yeah. I think that is probably something that's being established here by the reference that Jesus made to this. So I ask a question in verse 2. Is Mark 2:26, in Mark 2:26, this episode speaks of Abiathar as the officiating priest. How may this be harmonized with what we read in this chapter? Because who is the priest in this chapter?
It's Ahimelech here. But
yeah, Ahimelech is a father of Abiathar. And both were probably present at that time. So one is being mentioned by the Lord, another is being mentioned by the author of the book of 1 Samuel. But obviously they both were there and probably were together. And when you have a conversation going on with more than one person, one party may refer to this person, where another party may refer to that person.
Well, doesn't Mark say that Abiathar is a high priest?
In the days of, that's what it says, of the high priest.
So, Abiathar could be the high priest of Ahimelech, being one of the lower priests, at least for that year.
Sure, sure. I have no problem with that at all. All right, verse 7.
Now one of the servants of Saul was there that day, detained before the Lord, and his name was Doeg the Edomite, the chief of Saul's shepherds.
Okay, I don't know how to pronounce his name. I'm just going to call it Dog. That's what it looks like to me, even though it's not spelled the way we spell the word dog. Who was he? Well, he was a chief of Saul's shepherds, which would have been considered a real important position in that day. He would have been a person of some importance and taking care of Saul's wealth in the form of sheep. Now, why was he detained before the Lord? We're not really told, though several answers have been suggested. He might be there to participate in purification rites. He may have been sent there to find out if he had been properly diagnosed with a skin disease. You remember when people were suspicioned of having leprosy, they would be sent to the priest, and the priest would be the one who served as a dermatologist in that day to pronounce them clean or unclean, as the case may be. He may have been performing some vow. We're just not really told the exact meaning of his being there. Why is he mentioned here at this time? So that we will not see him as a stranger later on when we meet him again. This fellow is going to be a tattletale. He is going to let the king know that David was there and what happened while David was there. And it's going to get the priests into serious trouble. They're not aware of what's happening at this time or what the future is going to be, but he's going to be responsible for 85 priests losing their lives because he was there to see what was happening. All right, verses 8 and 9, please.
David said to Ahimelech, "Now is there not a spear or sword on hand? For I brought neither my sword nor my weapons with me because the king's matter was urgent." Then the priest said, "The sword of Goliath the Philistine, whom you killed in the valley of Elah, behold, it is wrapped in a cloth behind the ephod. If you would take it for yourself, take it, for there is no other except it here." And David said, "There was none like it. Give it to me."
All right, why would David request a spear or a sword? It is a pretty practical request, isn't it? Do you think that he... I'm sorry. What?
I was going to say, that was a pretty big old sword for that boy this morning.
Well, yes, it was. Also, he saw this fellow that is taking care of Saul's sheep, and he may have suspicioned, you know, with his being here and knowing who he is and what he's seen, I may have more trouble than I'm thinking about, and I may need to have more protection than I really have at this point. So he asked for help on this occasion. How does David explain his not having weapons with him? Yeah, he had to leave so quickly. He didn't have time to bring his weapons with him. Is the identity of the king left ambiguous? Yes, it is. So is he speaking of Saul or God? What was the sword of Goliath doing in Nob?
That's where the tabernacle and stuff was, and that was a trophy of war.
Yeah, it surely was. I think that's the reason it was there. Now, what was the ephod?
And that's the ephod is what they were.
Yes, it's the vestment that the priest identified himself as a priest in war. So it's a part of their garment, and it was the high priest's shoulder dress. Then David arose and fled that day from Saul and went to Achish, king of Gath. Now, what is strange about David fleeing to Gath? Who once lived here? Goliath did, right. And here he's coming to the very place where the man who owned this sword had it and was going to use it, but David used it instead. Why Gath?
Because it was a Philistine, and it'd be less likely to be found out.
That's right. If he wants to protect himself from Saul, he needs to get out of Saul's territory. And he figures right now he probably has a better chance of being safe in the territory of the Philistines than he does in the territory of Saul. And about 5 years have passed since the time that he had killed Goliath. Yes, I'm sorry.
The Philistines still knew of David and the triumphs of David.
Oh, yeah, they sure would. That kind of news spreads pretty quickly. They would know that. All right, verse 11, please.
But the servant of Achish said to him, "Is this not David, the king of the land? Did they not sing of this one as they danced, saying, 'Saul has slain his thousands, and David his 10,000'?"
Was David able to live among the Philistines incognito? No, they recognized him. Who was skeptical of David's presence in Gath? The servants of Achish, right. The psalms written on this part of David's life are Psalm 34, Psalm 52, and Psalm 56. Now, each of these three psalms, 34, 52, and 56, have what we call a superscription. What's a superscription? Yes. Sometimes it told that. Sometimes it said when it was written. There were a lot of different kinds of information that were given in the superscriptions. Not every psalm had a superscription, but the superscriptions were very important and identified many times the author or the occasion that prompted the song, or to give instructions as to the melody that should be used when it's sung, or some other kind of instructions to the musicians. Why was David believed to be the king of the land?
Because the king is a leader, and when David went out and slew Goliath, they looked at him as a leader.
Yes, early on they really recognized that here's a man with unusual abilities, and God was certainly blessing him. And they'd heard the words of the song that were singing, that the people were singing about the praise they gave to Saul, but the greater praise they gave to David. All right, verses 12 and 13.
David took these words to heart and greatly feared Achish, king of Gath. So he disguised his sanity before him and acted insanely in their hands, and scribbled on the doors of the gate and let his saliva run down into his beard.
Was David fearful of what Achish might do because of his attitude, because of the attitude of his servants? Yes, he thought he would be arrested and killed, perhaps. Are we informed of the location of David's men at this time?
No.
No. Did David's behavior suggest that he was a threat to others?
Well,
probably so.
People
in that day regarded madness as something that they needed to be very cautious about, and they would not want to in any way inflict any injury upon a person who was insane.
He also had that great big sword.
Yeah. Okay. How is saliva running down the beard considered by others?
Horrible.
Yeah, and insulting also. Very much insulting and rude. Was David's pretense effective with Achish?
Yes.
Yes, it was. He played the part pretty well. Then Achish said to his servants, "Behold, you see the man behaving as a madman? Why do you bring him to me? Do I lack madmen that you have brought this one to act the madman in my presence? Shall this one come into my house?" So does David escape danger on this occasion?
Yes.
Yes, he does. Did Achish fear personal injury if David was not removed from his presence?
Yes,
he did. So what David is doing here is pretty shrewd, to make sure that he protects himself and his men wherever they are at this point. Now, chapter 22 is giving us a picture of David growing in power while Saul's anger is getting out of control and causing him to do a lot of things that are very foolish. He fled to Gath and found a safe haven at the cave of Adullam, and we're going to read about that now in this chapter 22. We'll read verses 1 and 2.
So David departed from there and escaped to the cave of Adullam. And when his brothers and all his father's household heard of it, they went down there to him. Everyone was in distress, and everyone who was in debt, and everyone who was discontented gathered to him, and he became captain over them. Now there were about 400 men with him.
All right, Adullam was a Canaanite city that was located about 16 miles southwest of Jerusalem. David's brothers would not have been very far from him, because this cave of Adullam was only about 12 miles from Bethlehem. Now, David is being joined at this time by his parents and his family servants and the relatives, but there are three other classes of people that are coming to rally to the cause of David. The first class of people are described as what? Those who are in distress, right. We're not told exactly the reason for the distress, but they had some personal concerns, and so they think, okay, let us go and rally with David.
Wouldn't that be the cities of refuge?
I'm sorry?
Wouldn't that be like the cities of refuge, as described in Genesis, when someone would kill somebody And it was like an accident. Yeah. They would send it up to the cities of Carthage.
Yeah, I understand what you're talking about. There were six cities of refuge, three on the east side and three on the west side of the Jordan River, two to the north, two to the south, and two in the middle, strategically located. I'm having difficulty seeing the connection, though, between these people following David and the cities of refuge.
Well, the cities of refuge, one understand, were cities that they would separate themselves from the common people that weren't in some type of trouble. And going here, the next part says, and those that were in debt.
That's the second group of people.
Yes, that's what I'm saying. That these would be people that would be separated from the common group that, you know, they've established themselves in debt. They can't repay the person, therefore they were sent away, so they got their own little city. So I'm trying to say, look at here is what I see is.
Yeah.
I
understand what you're saying. However, there is a clear distinction. If you escape to a city of refuge, nobody can touch you. But if you're going to follow David, they can still get you. This is going to help them out, they think. But it doesn't give them the protection that a city of refuge would give. You see that distinction?
Yes.
Okay. So there is a similarity. I understand that. But
maybe that's why they were in this distress, because they left their security of their refuge city.
Well,
they see David as a powerful man. They also see him as a man that's on the run and who's in trouble. And they said, well, here's a man that's like us. If it's in trouble, let's rally with him and he'll take care of us.
And that would answer your thought with regard to refuge, because if there's any one side you want to be on, it's a man that's had the kind of victories that David has had. Right. So there is a distinction, but there is also a similarity. Very good. All right, so the third group of people. We've mentioned the first two, those in distress and those who are in debt. Who's the third group of people? All right, does this sound like the kind of an army that David would really be thrilled to have?
Well, maybe they have a lot to fight for.
Sure, why not? At any rate, this increases his manpower by about how much?
400.
All right. Did David organize a group that had come to join him?
Yes.
Yes, he did. He became a captain over them and probably appointed some of the people within this group to be working under him to manage even smaller groups. Sure. All right, verse 3, please.
And David went from there to Mizpah of Moab, and he said to the king of Moab, please let my father and my mother come and stay with you until I know what God will do for me.
All right, why did David leave the cave of Adullam?
To get his mother and father set where they'd be protected.
Yeah, this is not going to be a very long place where they can stay and be taken care of, and so he wants to make sure that he's made good arrangements for his parents. Does this bode well for David?
Yes.
Surely does. Was David still a man of faith in God?
Yes.
Yes, it certainly speaks well of him in that regard. Now, why would he have gone to Moab? His great-grandmother. Who was she? A Moabitess. What was her name?
Ruth.
That's exactly right. So he may have felt that there's some kinship here in their history, and that obviously they would be in the territory of one of Saul's adversaries. So at least this is getting him away from any potential danger that they might have from Saul.
The enemy of my enemy is my friend.
Okay. Then he left them with the king of Moab, and they stayed with him all the time that David was in the stronghold. Now, what's a stronghold?
The cave of Adullam.
Probably is. People are not totally agreed on that, but that very well could be what he's talking about here. Verse 5, please.
The prophet said to David, do not stay in the stronghold. Depart and go into the land of Judah. So David departed and went up into the forest of Herod.
Okay, now I'm curious. Your version does not give the name of the prophet?
No.
God.
Oh, okay.
You missed it.
Well, that's all right. I just thought you may have a version I'm not familiar with, and I wonder, okay, is there something here I should have picked up on? Okay, Gad is the one that is mentioned here. What does this verse tell us about the location of the stronghold?
Not stay.
All right, he's going, do not stay in the stronghold, depart and go into the land of Judah. That would suggest that it's where?
Not in Judah.
Not in Judah. Is this the first time we've been introduced to the prophet Gad? Yes, it is. Now, was Adullam outside the land of Judah? It's actually a part of Judah, but it was so close to the Philistine territory that you could almost regard it as a place that would be considered outside, though in a technicality it would be inside. Do we know anything else about Gad other than that which is mentioned in this verse?
That he's a prophet.
Yeah, of course that's mentioned in this verse. But we will read about him later on. And he is going to occupy a position of prominence among the followers of David. Will it be important for Gad to be with David? I think so. Who sent Gad to David at this time? Probably God was behind this. It could very well have been that Samuel had sent him. Samuel being aware of the school of the prophets who might be available. And many people believe that it was under the instructions of Samuel that this younger man, Gad, would be there to assist David as a prophet. Why did Gad tell David to go into the land of Judah? What is David going to ultimately become?
King.
The king. Should he be in the land where he's going to be the king?
Yes.
This would be a great advantage. He needs to identify with these people, and they need to recognize that he has not skipped out on them, and so he needs to maintain some kind of an identity with them. We are not really given adequate information here, but no doubt the people are going to sense, why'd you leave us alone? Why are you not here with us? The people recognize David's greatness. They recognize his superior military prowess to that of Saul. And so they would like to be in the area, or have him in the area where they are. David did follow Gad's advice, and he re-entered Judah and came to the place about 5 or 6 miles southeast of Hebron. Verse 6.
Then Saul heard that David and the men who were with him had been discovered. Now Saul was sitting in Gibeth under the tamarisk tree on the height with his spear in his hand, and all the servants were standing around him.
All right, what is the purpose? What purpose is served by the remaining verses in this chapter?
Shows where the relation between the two of the...
All right, it's locating their differences as far as geography is concerned. It's also indicating the next steps that are going to be taken that are going to determine the fulfillment of prophecy concerning Eli's house, that it's going to ultimately be destroyed. So we're setting the stage for that to come into the play. Why would it have been inevitable that David's location would be discovered?
You can't hide forever.
That's right, and particularly when you've got 400 men with you.
And you're so prominent, everybody knows you.
Yeah. Now, the significance of the tamarisk tree here in Gibeah, this was a special species of tree that was rare in this part of the land. That probably accounts for it being identified because it was not just the regular tree that you would expect to find here. Eastern kings frequently sat in the shade of a tree in the open air, and this is not anything unusual about Saul's location here. Verse 7, please.
Saul said to the servants who stood around him, "Hear now, O Benjamites, will the son of Jesse also give to all of you fields and vineyards? Will he make you all commanders of thousands and commanders of hundreds?"
All right, what is significant about the mention of the Benjamites? That's his own tribe, isn't it? He's speaking to them. How is Saul's anger against David shown in this verse? Does he mention him by name?
No,
I think that's deliberate. I think he refers to him as the son of Jesse, but he doesn't mention him by name when he's his own son-in-law. Is Saul seeking to turn his men against David?
Yes.
Oh, absolutely. Verses 11 through 13, please. I'm sorry. Yes, let's take verse 8. I turned two pages at once.
For all of you have conspired against me, so that there is no one who disposes to me when my son makes a covenant with the son of Jesse. And there is none of you who is sorry for me or discloses to me that my son has stirred up my servant against me to lie in ambush as it is this day.
Okay, what accusation does Saul make against those who are with him on this occasion? You're against me. You're conspiring against me. Why are you doing this? How does Saul support his charge against these men?
Through his son Jonathan.
Actually, he gives two pieces of evidence, doesn't he? The first one being, he tells me, no one tells me when my son made a covenant with the son of Jesse. That bothers him. And he suggests that his servants are really not committed to him like they ought to be, or they'd be doing a lot more to help him out. Now, why had no one warned Saul of dangers? That's right, there wasn't any danger. This is in his own imagination. He's his own worst enemy here. Does Saul speak the truth in this verse? No, he does not. All right, let's read more about this Edomite in verses 9 and 10.
And Dr. Edomite, who was standing by the servants of Saul, said, I saw the son of Jesse coming to Nob, to Ahimelech, the son of Hattu. He inquired of the Lord for him, gave him provisions, and gave him the sword of Goliath, the Philistine.
Okay, now the psalm that relates what we're going to be studying at this point in 1 Samuel is Psalm 52. A lot of the psalms now are directly related to these various events that are unfolding during the time that David is a fugitive. So this one is going to be mentioned in Psalm 52. Now, why is Dog referred to as an Edomite in verses 8, verses 9 rather, 18 and 22? This indicates that I think this is trying to emphasize the fact that he's not one of the Israelites, but he is responsible for something that's going to happen on this occasion. By the way, was it unusual for a person of foreign extraction to be employed in an army?
No.
No, it was not. The Israelites did this, other nations did that also. Now, what is significant about the words of Dog on this occasion? All right, they were true words, but on this occasion, under the circumstances, it left a bad impression with Saul, and it's going to lead to some terrible consequences. Did Dog express his opinion that Ahimelech had committed treason in giving David provisions?
Yes.
And the sword of Goliath?
Yes.
Yes, he did. Verses 11 through 13, please.
Then the king sent someone to summon Ahimelech the priest, the son of Ahitub, and all his father's household, the priests who were in Nob, and all of them came to the king. Saul said, listen now, son of Ahitub. And he answered, here I am, my lord. Then Saul said to him, why have you and the son of Jesse conspired against me, and that you have given him bread and a sword, and have inquired of God for him, so that he would rise up against me by lying in ambush as it is this day?
All right, did Saul view Ahimelech as a threat? Yes, that's the reason he sent for him. Why did Saul send all the priests when Dog only reported the action of Ahimelech?
He sent a message.
That's right. And he considered, if one of them's against me, chances are they're all in cahoots, they're all against me. Did Saul confront Ahimelech with a report he had received from Dog?
Yes.
Yes, he did. Did Saul accuse Ahimelech of aiding David so that David could destroy him?
Yes.
Yes, he did. Why should Saul have known that Ahimelech and the priests were not plotting against him? What did they do? Did they not answer the summons to come to him? I mean, do men willingly come to be killed? I don't think so. Obviously, they didn't think that they had done anything wrong. They didn't intend to do anything wrong. And they obviously were not aware of Saul's anger, the degree of it, and his determination to destroy David. Then Ahimelech answered the king and said, "And who among all your servants is as faithful as David, even the king's son-in-law, who is captain over your guard and is honored in your house?" This is the priest answering the king. "Did I just begin to inquire of God for him today? Far be it from me. Do not let the king impute anything to his servant or to any of the household of my father, for your servant knows nothing at all of this whole affair." Does Ahimelech answer Saul honestly? Yes, he does. Why did Ahimelech consider David worthy of help? That's right.
He hadn't heard anything otherwise.
That's right. How can I know all this is going on behind the scenes? I've not been told. He's your son-in-law, not mine. He was the captain of your bodyguard, not mine. He was highly respected among all the people. Everyone knows that. What have you got against me? Had any precedent been set for Ahimelech's actions with David? Well, he inquired of the Lord for David on a previous occasion. Notice in verse 15, "Did I not just begin to inquire of God for him today?" Was Ahimelech, in other words, he's talked about having helped him in the past. Did I just start doing this now? No, I've done this before. Was Ahimelech aware of any rebellion on the part of David?
No.
Did Ahimelech plead innocent of Saul's charges?
Yes,
he did. Verse 16.
The king said, "You shall surely die, Ahimelech, you and all your father's house."
Was Saul convinced that Ahimelech was telling him the truth?
No.
No, he wasn't. Was anger and suspicion dictating Saul's actions?
Yes.
Now, folks, you just don't behave properly when you're angry. Verse 17.
And the king said to the guards who were attending, "Turn around and put the priest of the Lord to death. Their hand also is with David, and because they knew that he was fleeing and did not reveal it to me." But the servants of the king were not willing to put forth their hands and attack the priests of the Lord.
All right, were the king's officials willing to lift up their hands against the anointed one of the Lord? No, they were not, to their credit. Did Saul's men recognize that Saul's order was cruel and wrong?
Yes.
That should have been a warning to Saul. He's taking unfair advantage of his authority. Verses 18 and 19.
Then the king said to Dark, "Turn around and attack the priest." And Dark the Edomite turned around and attacked the priest. And he killed that day 85 men who wore the linen ephod. And he struck Nob, the city of the priest, with the edge of the sword, both men and women, children and infants. Also oxen, donkeys, and sheep he struck with the edge of the sword.
What clearly identified these men as priests?
The linen ephod.
That's right, the vestment they were wearing. Was Saul actually declaring war on God with this action?
Yes.
Did Dog hesitate in obeying the king's order?
No.
No, he did not. How do the Jewish writings speak of Dog?
He's a dog.
He's a dog. In the Jewish writings, they claim hold him to be one of the worst of all the persons who appear as wicked people in the Old Testament. What makes the extermination of Nob so terrible? The killing of infant people, innocent people, women, children, and infants. How does Saul's actions on this occasion compare with his actions earlier against the Amalekites?
Crazier all the time.
That's right, crazier all the time. He didn't kill the king. He didn't kill their best animals. Now he's killing people that are totally innocent. What was the purpose of the massacre?
Craziness.
All right. Indeed, it was insanity on the part of the king. But one son of Ahimelech, the son of Ahitub, named Abiathar, escaped and fled after David. Do we know how Abiathar was able to escape? No, we do not. with the death of Ahimelech, and would Abiathar now become the high priest? Well, yes, he would. Would Abiathar escape the judgment of God pronounced against the house of Eli? No, ultimately, he would not. Whatever God declares is going to bring down a household, you can be sure that's going to happen. Abiathar told David that Saul had killed the priest of the Lord. Then David said to Abiathar, "I knew on that day when Dog the Edomite was there that he would surely tell Saul, 'I have brought about the death of every person in your father's household.'" Did David feel personally responsible for what had happened?
Yes.
Yes, he did. He feels very badly about this. Though David knew that Dog would inform Saul of what he had seen and heard at Nob, did David have any idea of the seriousness of the consequences?
No.
He did not. "Stay with me. Do not be afraid. For he who seeks my life seeks your life, for you are safe with me." Was Abiathar the last descendant of Eli to serve as high priest?
Yes,
well, yes, he was. Did David offer Abiathar protection from Saul?
Yes.
He did. What is the main point of this chapter? That's right. David has great respect for the prophets of God. He has great respect for the priests of God. David is a fugitive. He is a very sensitive man. He feels very sorry about what has happened, but he recognizes that God is in control, and he's going to honor those who represent God to the people. Thank you, Father, for these precious moments of Bible study. Thank you for challenging our thinking. Help us to see how the behavior of people that lived centuries ago is still with us today. Help us to think sanely. Help us to behave godly. Help us to reach right decisions. And help us never to doubt that we are always safe with you. Thank you for your divine protection and for your divine provision and for your divine purpose that you've instilled in us, so that every day is lived knowing that it's not in vain when we live for you. Dismiss us now with your blessing, I pray in Jesus' name. Amen.